Hello, this is Deborah Kelso, host of this edition of Nature Now for the first week of the brand new year of 2020. Given the fact that our trumpeter swans have now returned to spend the winter with us and are such a splendid sight in our local valley bottoms right now, we decided to make them our main topic for this week. This week we present an encore of a show that Mary Robson recorded about 3 years ago with birder extraordinaire Bob Boglehyde, who spoke with us about tracking trumpeter swans with a new citizen science project on the Olympic Peninsula. But before we get to our main topic, let's first hear the mystery sound of the week. Isn't this a cool sound?
Yes.
We'll play it again at the end of the program and tell you what it is.
With all the bleak environmental news out there, it is good to start the new year with something positive. And just last week, the Seattle Times reported on a rare environmental success story unfolding in waters off the U.S. West Coast. After years of fear and uncertainty, bottom trawler fishermen, those who use nets to scoop up rockfish, bokashio, sole, Pacific Ocean perch, and other deep-dwelling fish are making a comeback here, reinventing themselves as a sustainable industry less than two decades after authorities closed huge stretches of the Pacific Ocean because of the species depletion.
Ban devastated fishermen, but on January 1st, regulators will reopen an area roughly three times the size of Rhode Island off Oregon and California to ground fish bottom trawling, all with the approval of environmental groups who were once the industry's biggest foes. The two sides collaborated on a long-term plan that will continue to resuscitate the groundfish industry while permanently protecting thousands of square miles of reefs and coral beds that benefit the overfished species.
It's really a conservation home run, said Shems Judd, Regional Director for the Environmental Defense Fund's Ocean Program. The recovery is decades ahead of schedule. It's the biggest environmental story that no one knows about.
Yahoo! And growing as high as your head, reed canary grass is a tough, non-native weed from the Mediterranean region that has been invading our wetland habitats. The grasses are decay-resistant, and the light yellow stems become conspicuous in winter around lakes and streams and disturbed moist fields at this time of year. During our long winter nights, it can be readily observed growing along roadside ditches, even by the light of your vehicle's headlights. Canary grass is a species worth getting to know, as wetland restoration projects inevitably must contend with its control, which involve ground tarping, fire, flooding, and replanting with native species.
There has been a lot going on the local birding news of late, but you will have to wait a bit until we can report back with the full details. Last week's show featured that annual Christmas bird count for the Port Townsend area, which took place on December 14th. But there are several other places on the Olympic Peninsula that conducted them. Nea Bay did their count on December 15th, Squims followed on the 16th, with Port Angeles the very last, just finishing up a couple of days ago on the 28th. We will report back on the highlights from all these other counts when the results are tallied in a couple more weeks.
As most of you know, whenever Earth encounters a stream of gritty debris left in space by a passing comet, the result is a meteor shower. If we are blessed with clear skies this week, we will be treated to a view of the quadranted meteor shower, due to peak on January 4th. A shower gets its name not from its parent object, but from the constellation where its originating point or radiant lies. For example, August's well-known Perseid shower has its radiant in Perseus, December's Geminids appear to radiate from Gemini, and so forth. One notable exception to this rule is the quadranted shower, named for the now-defunct constellation Quadrans Muralis. Its radiant lies in the constellation Boots. Look to the northeast on January 4th. It is best seen after midnight, and on exceptionally good years, it is possible to see 200 meteors per hour. Now on to Mary's interview with Bob Boglehyde.
Bob Boglehyde, whom we will be talking with now, educates birders, both the experienced and the new, to appreciate the amazing variety of bird life from the sea to the mountains here on the Olympic Peninsula. Hi, Bob. I've already introduced you as someone who helps all of us appreciate the amazing variety of birds on the Olympic Peninsula and other places. But today I'd like to talk about trumpeter swans, because many of us see them but don't know much about their lives. So can you start by telling us a little bit about what types of swans we have, where they originate, and about when do they get here?
Sure. Well, thank you, Mary. So there's two native swan species that we see here in Washington State. The big guys, the large ones, are trumpeter swans. And trumpeter swans that we have here mostly nest in Alaska. They nest in the forested areas of Alaska. After the nesting season, they fly south, usually in the fall, September, October. They arrive here in November. The first ones arrive here in November or so. And we have trumpeter swans gathering not only the North Olympic Peninsula, which is a relatively small group compared to the large groups that are over in the Skagit Valley, like near Mount Vernon, and the Samish Flats, and all the way up into Whatcom County and in southern British Columbia. So those are trumpeter swans. The smaller swan species that we have is the tundra swan, used to be called the whistling swan, and they mostly nest up in the Arctic. They don't nest where there are forests. They nest in the kind of the lowlands around the Arctic, both in Alaska and Canada. They fly further south than trumpeter swans usually, so big numbers of them are down in starting about the southern part of Washington into the Willamette Valley of Oregon and down into California. So we're in the big trumpeter swan area here. And they're coming here to spend the winter. They usually arrive in November sometime. Numbers increase through the winter until finally about the middle of March. Sometime in February, March, they reach a peak, and then they decline very quickly, and they're gone. Usually the last few are here in the first few days of April.
One of the things that has happened for Clallam County is that you've been keeping track of swans through this citizen science project, the swan monitoring, and there are volunteers who help you keep, I know not, you said that you personally have not been usually counting swans, but these volunteers help keep track of the swans, particularly in the Squim Dungeness Valley. I talked with one person who was one of the people who started it, Mary Porter Solberg, and she wrote about why she loves swans, and I think we'll just give Mary her words here. She said, "As long as I can remember, swans have always captivated me in a way other birds could not compete. From the downy cygnet stage of their lives until they emerge as magnificent adult birds, they have fascinated me." And she said that she spent time drawing them and reading books about them when she was a child. So that gets us started on the swan monitoring project. How does that work?
Swans have a real draw for us, you know, not only in literature and in music. And, you know, there's many ways that people are attracted to swans. The ugly duckling is another good example. The project here started back about, the year 2010 or so. Well, actually, going back even further, we do a Christmas bird count here in the Squim Dungeness Valley. We had no trumpeter swans at all on our count here until 1982. And the numbers picked up slowly over the years. We had a big jump up in 2008. And between 2008 and 2011, we started to see occasionally there were a sick swan, you know, a swan that would separate from the group, that would hang out, looked like it was having some sort of malaise, and eventually they may die. The question was, what was going on? Well, there were a number of people here. One was Shelley Amott, who works for the State Wildlife Department, State Department of Fish and Wildlife, and Martha Jordan, who was very active in the Trumpeter Swan Society, now part of the Washington Swan Stewards. And they were wondering whether lead could have been the problem. Apparently, swans are very susceptible to lead poisoning. And the question is, where could they be picking up lead? They could ingest just a few old spent shotgun pellets that could have been lying around on the ground for years. Lead shot has been illegal for waterfowl hunting for decades, back to the 1990s, and many places even before that. So they were ingesting this from somewhere out there. We didn't know where. And so the question was, let's follow the swans and see where they're spending their time. If we see sick swans after that, then maybe we can get a connection and figure out where they're ingesting the lead pellets. So both Martha Jordan and Shelley Amott approached the Olympic Peninsula Audubon Society, of which Mary Porter Solberg is the conservation chair, and ask, would we be interested in doing surveys, just driving around. A wonderful example of a citizen science project where volunteers basically just have to recognize a swan. And the swans are so obvious standing out in these fields, people would have to count them, be able to separate adult swans from juvenile swans by coloration, and have a regular route of where people go and they communicate with each other. So the idea was, starting in 2011, let's do these surveys, driving around, checking out where the swans are. We now are up to 24 people who have helped with this project as far as driving around and checking out the swans. So it's turned into a really neat project. Where I fit in, I have not been one of the 24 people who have driven around, but we've now accumulated quite a bit of data. And so you can imagine, when it first started in 2011 and 12 and 2012-13, there were many surveys done. People were tripping over each other, going out trying to count swans. And so we have a lot of data from those years. We then cut back in 2013-14 and 14-15. So we do it as a more regular survey in this year as well, from 2015-16. So regardless, we have all this data. We want to know, what does it mean? And so some of the basic questions, like how many swans are showing up every year, and where do they go while they're here? Why are they, you know, what habitats are they using? And how do their ages change over time? So all these basic questions beyond what we might be interested in, what might be killing swans because of lead. It turns out now there have been fewer birds affected by lead since then. Other problems have arisen. I'll talk about them in a second here.
Okay. The other thing is, because this actually is a citizen science project, I looked at the data sheet, and the people who are doing this need to be very particular about everybody reporting the same thing. So you're not confronted with one person's impression and another person's impression, but it's very regularized.
Yes, that's exactly right. And that's particularly true when doing, you know, any sort of science project. You need to have a fairly strict protocol that requires people to be consistent in their observations. And not only because it gives us a better picture of the birds, but also it makes it a lot easier in the end when you're trying to compile the numbers and make sense out of it. One person might call a field, say, a pasture. Another person might call it a cover crop. Another person might call it winter wheat. We need to somehow standardize those so that people are all consistent in what they're how they're describing the data as they do it.
Well, the other part of the description is that in a swan flock, you're going to see adults and juveniles. And the juveniles are a kind of grayish brown and a little smaller. But I wondered if you could talk a bit about these family groups. Do they stay together the times that they're here? Do they move around? How does a person know that they haven't already just counted the same swans on one day?
There's always a chance that the swans are flying around while the people are moving around and driving around, but they have regular places that they go to where they would look for the swans. As far as the young swans go, they stand out quite well. Trumpeter swans, the juveniles are this darker grayish color through the whole winter, and so they really don't start their molt out of that plumage until the following spring. So when the volunteers are going to a field, they can count the number of adults and the number of immatures that they see out in these fields. And to me, this is one of the most interesting things that have come out of this project is when we look at the number of juveniles that show up, they usually reach a peak sometime in fairly early, like November, December, and their numbers change a little bit through the winter, but they don't have the same increase as the adults. Oftentimes, the adult numbers keep going up. And it appears that the family groups, the successful adults who have young birds with them, remain in the areas somewhere around here fairly consistently. That's the way that I interpret the data. Maybe I'm totally wrong about this, but I interpret the data that these family groups that were successful breeding adults stay with their young through the season in these spots. We get this big increase in adults later on in the late winter and particularly through February and March, and those seem to be maybe either failed breeding adults, birds that never had chicks, maybe they left the breeding grounds after their chicks died, or they could be young birds. Trumpeter swans usually don't nest for the first time until they're maybe 4 to 7 years old. And
wow.
So these young birds may pair in their first couple years, but they may go for 2 or 3 years before they actually settle down and have a successful nest. So those birds are traveling together. And what interesting thing about swans is they're perhaps the most monogamous bird species that's out there. There's probably a few exceptions, like wren tits and things like that, but these swans are traveling as pairs, breeding pairs, through the whole year. We hear about birds mating for life. Well, trumpeter swans may be a good example of that. There are probably a few examples where maybe there are splits. Maybe certainly there are records of where one of the mates dies and the other mate will pair with another individual at some other point. But in general, they're traveling as mated pairs, whether they have chicks or not. But it seems like the adults with young arrive in early winter or late fall. They stay fairly continuously here, but then the unattended adults are traveling around. They may be going maybe from the Skagit Valley over here on a regular basis. Maybe they're flying from here back to the Skagit Valley. The numbers are going up and down through the winter. There's no real strong consistency all the way through. Sometimes it seems like they're increasing. Sometimes it seems like they decrease. But overall, the general trend is the numbers pick up through the winter. They reach a peak in February, March, and then very quickly they depart in the spring.
But one of the things that contributes to the success of nesting was, we talked a little bit about this, the little cygnets, when they hatch, are precocial. They can hop out of the nest in 24 hours and swim and eat right away?
Yes. And this is when they're most vulnerable to, say, weather problems. If they get some really cold weather snap in Alaska, that might cause widespread death of these very young cygnets before they're able to thermoregulate. They have to learn how to feed. The parents don't feed them. The parents take them to the food. But those young cygnets have to learn the ropes, so to speak, and figure out which foods they should use. Apparently, there's examples of the parents actually kind of stirring up sediment in some of these lakes to try to get the young cygnets to see what foods are available to them.
Wow.
So there's a learning process, and they don't all make it.
Mm-hmm.
Some years they have widespread breeding failure. Some years they do very well. This is typical in wild bird populations.
Well, what I was wondering also was that obviously there is something in the local habitat here that attracts and supports these swans. I mean, they're not headed for the Cascades to sit on a mountain. They're here. So what is it that they need from this area?
Yeah, well, there's some great habitat here. The first thing they need is wide open spaces. We have these agricultural fields here, some of the areas around Squim, like out by Schmuck Road and Port Williams Road, areas by Olympic Game Farm, some of these large areas where there's big fields. Swans during the daytime want to have feeding spots where they have a nice view around them. They want to see where there might be a predator approaching. They also want to have good food sources. And here, some of the best food that they've found in some of these fields, like corn, a spent corn field where it's been harvested. There's still lots of corn cobs lying around in the ground. This is nirvana for these swans coming here in the fall and the winter. An example right now, there's a field over by the Squim Airport that they've been using this year that they did not use before, and this is the first year that apparently it was planted in corn, so they're using that. Other places here, Nash Huber with Nash's Organic Farm has planted carrots for many years, and it turns out at a certain time during the winter, that is also a very favorite spot, particularly after they've harvested the carrots. The swans will go in and consume all the carrots they can get to. Other areas, they're general vegetarians, so they'll be nibbling on grasses. Some of the cover crops that they grow around here are favorite foods. So there's a wide variety of things that they'll eat here. And there's not only the habitat that they need during the day when they're feeding, but they also need habitat at night for roosting. So they may have special ponds in the area that they go to during the nighttime, or in late evening they'll fly to these ponds.
So they actually spend the night floating on some form of water.
Yes, and sometimes they float on salt water. We'll see them in flocks out in Dungeness Bay around the corner at Jamestown, where they'll hang out. And for those of you over on the Quimper Peninsula, places like Anderson Lake is a place where they'll go at nighttime.
And it's so a good place to go to see them wake up in the morning.
Fly from there out to the fields down at Center and Beaver Valley and places like that.
What do you think is the biggest threat to them now? Obviously, spent lead shot has killed birds, but what at this time is hurting them or making life tough for them. What about their future in this area?
Yeah, well, these are great questions. One of the big problems in our area here around Squim Dungeness Valley has been collisions with power lines. Shelley Ament has worked with the Clallam PUD to put markers or reflectors up on the power lines, which apparently highlight them a little bit more so the swans are less likely to run into them. In some cases, swans with their long wingspan may touch a couple power lines and be electrocuted. But mostly it's a collision. They're taking off in dusk, mm-hmm. and they don't see the power lines, and they collide with them, and it causes...
Their wingspread is about 9 feet, isn't it? Or a little more?
Extreme. So eight to 9 feet, somewhere in that range.
But if they're flying, that's a heck of a lot of wingspread. We have time for just one more question. We could go on and on, but the last question you've dealt with a little bit. If we didn't have open agriculture going on, we would not have these swans here.
I think that's very true. You know, there's some of them that may learn to be in areas that don't have large agricultural fields, but in general, that's true. If we're going to have large numbers of swans, trumpeter swans, particularly in our area, the lesson is these open agricultural spaces are a wonderful spot for them.
And they're not only good for us who like to eat, they're very good for the swans who like to eat then.
That's true. And
okay.
So we need to support farms that are providing this open space, whether they're crops or dairies or whatever, they provide important space for swans.
That's wonderful. You have looked at the question or touched on where people can go to see swans in the area. If they wanted to just drop in at Dungeness Audubon Society, they could get more information about where to look?
Sure. But for those people who live over in Port Townsend, the great spot to go to is down in the Center Valley.
Yes.
South of Chimicum, along the Beaver Valley. There are a number of farms there that have open space. Fortunately, the swans are here in the wintertime when most of these farms aren't growing crops. And so basically they need areas where they're not disturbed and they can survive in a nice, happy situation.
They can survive and give us a lot of pleasure by knowing that they're there. Bob, thank you so much. I appreciate your being here and letting us think a little bit more about the birds that make our winter so special. So thank you.
Thank you.
Many of our natural history groups had special events happening on New Year's Eve or New Year's Day, but are taking a bit of a break the rest of this week. You can, however, plan ahead for the annual Olympic Bird Fest, which is happening in mid-April this year, and is a fundraiser for the Dungeness River Audubon Center just outside of Squim. Online registration for this fine event opens on January 1st and features all kinds of great field trips and classes. Please go to olympicbirdfest.org for more details.
And here's our mystery sound again. It is the sound of a swan paddling the water with its giant webbed feet, wings whirring, gathering speed to lift off into the sky. As Bob Boglehyde mentioned in his talk with us, trumpeter swans are huge, the largest of our native waterfowl, and weigh in around 36 pounds average, and occasionally get up to 30 pounds. So you can imagine that they need quite a bit of space to gather enough speed to take off from the water, and it is thrilling to watch. The sound of their large feet plopping faster and faster as they gain speed is unmistakable and very dramatic. A good place to watch this locally is at Anderson Lake, where there are often small groups of trumpeter swans hanging out in the wintertime. Another good place to see trumpeter swans in our area are in the bottomlands of both the Center and Beaver Valleys. And that's it for KPTZ's Nature Now for the start of the new year. Thanks very much to Nora Petrich for her editing skill and for helping me share upcoming observations and events. And thanks to all of you for listening. Remember, if you missed any of our program or want to listen again, this program will be rebroadcast at 5 p.m. on Thursday, 12:30 on Saturday, and available as a podcast in a week or so at kptz.org. We at Nature Now wish you all a wonderful new year, along with many opportunities to get out and appreciate the amazing natural wonders that surround us every day. Closing music is New Year's Resolution by Camera Obscura.